on this computer. So thanks again, and the floor is yours.
I don't know what to say, man. So let me just start by saying that Professor Rasmi is the one that picked the title. Yani, wearing suits and technical analysis. So I got a lot of grief from former colleagues that use technical analysis to do their investment. So obviously, I just want to... Jerome Chahouin left. What the hell? So I just wanted to say that it wasn't my idea to pick the title. It was his idea. That said, I'm not a big believer in this. And a lot of people that have contacted me directly asked me what my favorite investment book is. And my favorite investment book, I tell them, is Random Walk Down Wall Street, which I read a long time ago. I'm not going to say how long. But that book, the thesis of that book is that index funds outperform the majority of managed funds, especially when you compensate for the fees that are paid. Of course, there is a place for technical analysis, which is the fact that if a lot of people believe in something, then it happens. So one of the things we look at when I was running a trading desk is the fact that you don't have to just guess where the market is going to go. You have to guess why the market is going a certain way. And one of the things is about the first order effects. So for example, if something happens negative, right? So it's not that people have a flight to safety like buying US dollars or US treasuries. What happens is that a lot of traders assume that people are going to do that. So they buy them or they try to buy them first. So the whole analysis of where the market is going sometimes isn't just about if the market is going to logically go up or down. It's about what do I think other people are going to do? And then what do I think the other people that think the other people are going to do, So you do this first order, second order, third order analysis to try to guess behavior. And then you try to follow the behavior. So in some ways, technical analysis, that when it works based on the fact that when the charts hit something like head and shoulders or whatever, people just, there are some things that you can predict simply because people follow the charts. A lot of people believe in the charts, and therefore you can use the charts to make some money. Of course, a chart, yani, something going through a moving average or whatever, isn't necessarily going to predict a Six Sigma event like, COVID-19 or the assassination of an important leader in the world or the war breaking out or something like that. Usually, those types of events, they depend more on this thing that I told you about, the first and second and third order analysis. So for example, let's say in 2002, the main event in 2002 was about whether there was going to be war with Iraq. Or 2001, 2002. So people were deploying funds on the basis, will there be war, will there not be war? Then when it became clear that it was a high probability event, people deployed funds, especially when they were pricing oil, depending on their prediction, whether the US was gonna win fast or whether they were gonna be bogged down, okay? Of course, there was a precedent for this thing, which is the 1989-1990 war with Iraq, where the U.S. Surprisingly won surprisingly fast. A lot of people didn't expect it to win that fast. But in the second time around, people assumed that there was a learning curve among the Iraqis. After all, they were fighting the same enemy twice. So on that basis, there was some projections that it was going to be harder and take longer, right? And on, of course, on the U.S. side, there was a lot of different type of stuff going on at the time. Rumsfeld, the Secretary of Defense, was trying out a hypothesis that he had. The plan of attack for the U.S. in those days, they have these in the U.S. they have these big plans of basically invading every country. And so usually what happens is it does start, you know, let's say that the president says, okay, we're going to attack Iraq. So what happens is the chairman of Joint Chiefs of Staff, he dusts off one of the files. He brings out this big folder, and the folder has all the stuff that needs to happen. How many troops, where they're going to come from, all this other stuff. And then what they do is they might adjust them or update them based on, because they're written years ago. So they might change some stuff in them. And at the time, the war in Iraq was supposed to cost something like 500,000 troops. And this was identical to the first war, the first Gulf War in the late 80s, early 90s. So when that happened, Rumsfeld, Wolfowitz, some of these other guys, they were saying, no, we don't need that many troops. So they kept going back to these guys to reduce the troop size, et cetera, because they were trying to prove a hypothesis that if you fight smart, you don't have to use a lot of resources. And to a large extent, they proved it right. Of course, when investors like us are looking at this thing, they are trying to guess if they're right or they're not right. At the time, it wasn't very clear that they were right, especially, you know, they were trying to go in with almost, I think, 25% of the level of troops the first time, you know, fighting an enemy who was supposed to be better trained because they have experience fighting that enemy. And therefore, it shouldn't have turned out to be as easy as it did. Of course, where the U.S. failed, or where the projections of Rumsfeld and others failed, is the aftermath of the war. So taking down a regime is pretty easy, but what's called nation building afterwards, you know, putting in place a stable regime that's friendly to you, that's where they didn't do very well. So from an investment perspective, you're trying to predict a lot of this stuff, okay? So you're trying to predict, will the war happen? And then if you're sure the war will happen, who's going to win? Will it be, will they be bogged down a long time like in Vietnam, or will they win very fast like 1989? And so on and so forth. So this is kind of the stuff that we look at. And same thing, when COVID happens, before COVID happens, nobody can predict it. So technical analysis is not going to predict that. But once there's a certain amount of stability, then these charts kind of work, because like I said, it depends on a lot of people doing the same thing and believing in them. So some of this stuff happens. But in most cases, the types of analysis we do, like the type of analysis I did in March, you might have seen some of the tweets. Like I went in and bought some Russell 2000. This is the small cap index. Small cap index is the most aggressive one. So what was I doing when I did that? So at the time I did an analysis and I had a lot of arguments on Twitter and other places about people that were doubting this. So it kind of depends. Did people believe that COVID was the end of the world, as some did? Or did they believe, like me, that it's an annoying, difficult thing, but it's not going to be the end of humanity? So this was essentially the argument or the bet. And of course, this bet isn't just about how the world will turn out. It's also a bet on investor sentiment. So again, back to the second order and third order behavior. So a lot of people sometimes like wonder why the stock market is overvalued based on fundamentals or whatever. So the reason for that is not because the market is supposed to reflect reality. It's because it's a leading indicator in many ways. And it also depends on, it reflects more the psychology of people rather than the fundamentals of the market in many cases. So back to my thesis at the time. So when the market was getting decimated in February and March, if you remember, I was going in and I was buying the Russell 2000. Why? Because I made an analysis. I said, okay, what's the worst case scenario? Every single human being ends up infected. Okay. 1% death rate, worst case scenario, 1% death rate. Generally, older population. Now, again, these are statistics from an investment perspective. Like if I'm the one that gets it and I die, it's kind of annoying for me. And it's annoying for my family. But on a statistical basis, you kind of can do the math. It's not a Hiroshima, Nagasaki type of thing. And you can also project what it means for a certain economy. So of course, it means less flights, it means less hotels, it means less thingy, but it also means the rise of things like what we're doing now, this Zoom thing. You know, a year ago or 2 years ago, you know, 95% of stuff wouldn't have happened like this. I wouldn't enjoy it, you wouldn't enjoy it. We kind of like the face-to-face. We like to look at the body language. I personally, when I talk to people, I like to look them in the eye. I like to see the body language and all that other stuff. But nevertheless, there are some technologies and some companies that evolve or that sprout from stuff like this. So on average, what does that mean for the market? There's a couple of things. There's first of all, an expression I learned on Wall Street a long time ago when I was a junior guy, which is don't fight the Fed. The Fed meaning the central bank of the United States. If the United States, the Federal Reserve, pumps a lot of money into it, it is, you know, you're going to have a very hard time being able to short that eventuality. It doesn't mean you'll always, you know, you'll always lose, but generally speaking, don't fight the Fed is one of the first things that I learned. The other one is, again, these are cliches, but they kind of, you know, there's a reason for cliches. The other one is the trend is your friend. So again, back to the thesis, my thesis in February, which I got right. You can go back to the tweet and see it. It's basically that, okay, is it the end of the world? No. In the worst case scenario, 1% death rate. Yeah, pretty bad for the families affected. Is it the end of the world from an investment perspective? No. In fact, in some cases, again, I don't mean to sound, unsympathetic or unempathetic, but in reality, when older people lie, you got to remember there are some demographic issues in the world, in Europe, for example. So what's the biggest challenge facing Europe today? It's the retirement plans of the European Union, right? People like the French, the Swedish, etc. What's happened there, they promised a lot of benefits to a lot of people who are now living longer. So in some sense, again, I'm talking in a very brutal sounding way, but I'm doing a investment analysis here. Same thing with the US Social Security. So when the Social Security system in the US was designed, people were supposed to live, you know, 2 years and then die. They weren't supposed to be supported by a pay-as-you-go system for 30 years as it is now. And of course, the medical costs, what's called Medicare, also blew out. So in other words, from an economic perspective, long-term, a 1% death rate among a certain demography is not necessarily negative for companies and the market. Okay, so that's about it. The suit thing about technical analysis. So the suit thing, the better guy that talks about this is Nassim Taleb. So I'm going to quote him a little bit here. He wrote a couple of things about the fact that what type of doctor do you prefer to go to? The guy who dresses up in an impeccable suit, etc., or the guy who's very rough looking. And he does a much better job. You can read his shit about this stuff. He does a much better job about that. So I've always felt that, especially in our country, in Lebanon, we attach too much importance. And I've been through the whole iterations. I was working at a time in investment banking where suits were mandatory. And when I was more junior, I kind of had to abide by that. And then we went through the dot-com phase where, you know, the dot-com guys were stealing employees from investment banks. So then investment banks decided to match them. First, they went to the Friday casual, then they went to everyday casual like the dot-coms. And then when dot-com blew up, you know, banks decided to go back to suits and so on and so forth. In my mind, I've always been uncomfortable with the whole idea of, I mean, there's a guy who said that, you know, wearing a tie all day, it's like a very weak guy strangling you all day. You know, it's not going to kill you, but it's very, very annoying all day long. So, in Lebanon, we attach a lot of importance to the type of stuff, the type of watch we wear, the type of, you know, not that I haven't been through that phase at points in my life, but I just felt that a lot of times there's an expression in Texas, you know, big hat, no cattle. Big hat, no cattle. So a guy has a big cowboy hat, but he doesn't have any cattle, no cows, no. So he's a cowboy with a big hat and nothing else. So in many cases, and you know, this is the type of stuff we try to infer a lot of things from the type of car somebody drives. I mean, I know a lot of people in Lebanon, I remember that their whole net worth was their car. The whole net worth was the car. I'm not going to talk more. Again, because of the Zoom thing, I feel uncomfortable just making a whole lecture one way. So I'd rather open it up to questions. And then depending on interest, I can just expand to what people want to hear.
Allow me. So to start with my own questions to make it some sort of dialogue, because this would be more interesting. I don't know if you see me on the phone, and then I'll go over the questions, because this is one thing Mind you, I am just a pseudo academic who knows shit. I did study finance, but then that's like, that was 10 years ago. So from a philosophy perspective, I hear you talking about, you know, statistics and 1% of the population is going to be dying. And then this is not really bad for someone who's an investor, blah, blah, blah. Aren't you, or wouldn't there be some sort of an ethical dimension to what you just said? Like you're saying that as though, you know, numbers and money and that's it. It's like, for me, this is a bit disconcerting.
Yeah, I mean, again, you're absolutely right. If this were the whole dimension of me or my personality, then, you know, I should be a, you know, a Nazi war criminal. But no, I'm trying to limit the conclusions here to a very small dimension of the world. And you have to look at this stuff. I mean, if you think about what an insurance executive does, right? You know, I mean, you don't know this behind the scenes, but what an insurance salesman does is when he comes and sells you an insurance policy, what he does is he makes an assessment on your likelihood to die in various years. And this happens behind the scenes. There's a whole science called actuarial science on this stuff. So, for example, what happened, you know, when they sell you a life insurance policy. So women live on average, they used to live 7 years more than guys. You know, as part of the developing equality between men and women, they now live only 4 years more than guys. So if I were to, you know, if I'm an insurance company and I wanted to insure you versus your wife, all else being equal, your insurance policy would cost more. Okay. And this is priced in. There's tables about this stuff. The other thing in a car insurance in places like the US, again, a woman would cost less to insure because you're more likely to crash your car as a guy. On the other hand, if I were to sell you an insurance annuity, I don't know if you know what an insurance annuity is, but it's basically a something that pays off. You give the insurance company $100,000 and they'll pay you a salary for life.
Yep.
Now, obviously the insurance company wants you to die as soon as possible. You want to live as long as possible. So you screw the insurance company by living much longer. So here the reverse happens. So you as a guy, because you live less than your wife, that annuity will pay you a bit more than it pays her, okay? Then there's a insurance annuity with survivor benefits. What that means is you buy one on yourself, and then if you die, your wife gets the rest when you die. So that one is, again, of course, more expensive or pays out less. So again, in life, we do these type of calculations all the time. The guy who's selling you the insurance policy, the guy wearing the suit and the Rolex watch, isn't going to talk about this morbid shit with you, right? But that's exactly what it is. In fact, if you think about what you do when you buy an insurance policy, like let's say you buy a $100,000 insurance policy. So you're paying something like, $200 a year for it, okay? Every year you pay $200, first year, second, this guy, $200 a year. So when do you win? That's a question. When do you win?
When?
You're paying me. I'm an insurance guy. You're paying me every year. You're paying me $20.
When, of course, I would end up.
When you die.
Yeah.
When you die. That's precisely your winning scenario.
Yep.
How about when you buy insurance on your car? So you're paying the insurance company, again, let's say $1,000 a year, you know, for your Jeep Cherokee or whatever, right? And then, so when do you win? You paid him $1,000 first year, second year, third year, fourth year, fifth year, you sold the car. If you did that, did you win?
Nope.
You just paid $5,000 to
the insurance company. When you crashed the fuck out of it.
Precisely. So the whole, you know, so there's a lot of morbid type stuff that goes on, you know, in life that we don't talk about, but it's factual. So these types of calculations are quite normal.
Yes, but this is the thing. It's calculations are normal, but then the other question would be in this case and investment versus whatever. In this case, it's a bit different, but. And I'll get to the questions. There are many interesting questions.
I have a nice one for you.
Yeah.
I have a nice one. Since you like ethics, I'm going to give you another investment that is very common these days. Let's say that I have a life insurance policy for $1 million. And let's say I go to the doctor tomorrow and he diagnoses me with terminal cancer.
Yeah.
So they give me an estimate that I'm going to die in 6 months. So there are people that will buy the insurance policy from me. They'll pay me a percentage of that so that I can enjoy the money now while I'm alive. Yeah. Is this ethical or unethical?
See, this is someone, Pierre, I think, is saying, you know, it's so you're two things. On the one hand, this is supposed to be like risk hedging, not something that we should think about in terms of, okay, I win, I lose. It's like you hedge your downside, no? Without thinking in terms of should I win or should I lose? Does it have to be that kind of... And I'll tie it back with the banks, for example, the situation that is happening in Lebanon. Isn't this kind of constant the mentality to want to rip the other person off or to want to make the most out of such insurance policies or investments and businesses what ends up fucking us up?
Yeah, it's I mean the statistics behind this stuff is what makes the world go round. And make no mistake about it. Ethics is important and it's a major concern. And obviously, you know, it's a factor. But I'll give you a practical example. If you look at how insurance companies work, let's go the medical. So, for example, a guy like me or you, if I want to buy, and I'm talking about the days of the Alf Kharsmit Lira, the bag. So, yeah. Give you an example. Let's say I want to insure my family in the best insurance policy in Lebanon. It might have cost me... because I'm not covered, let's say, by AUB like you were LAU.
I'm so not.
I would pay $5,000 a year to cover myself and my family in the old days. Right. What happens next year? They'll raise it. It'll be 6,000.
Yeah.
The year after 7,000 and so on. By the time, I mean, when am I likely to use it, by the way? When I'm our age or when I'm 70 or 80? So if you do a projection on the type of increase they'll give, the insurance company will do on you, what happens is by the time you're 70, that same policy would cost something like $25,000.
Yeah.
Now, if you're making $2,000 a month, right, and you're paying $500 of it for insurance, it's a lot, but it's, you know, doable. $3,000, let's say you're making, doable. But if you're making, let's say $3,000, by then you're making $5,000 a month. Now you're paying $25,000, so 50% or something of your salary on your insurance policy. So what ends up happening is a lot of people will give up that policy if they can't afford it. So the way the insurance company maximizes its profits is basically by insuring you when you don't need them, right?
Yeah.
And then when you need them, they will make the cost prohibitive. They know what they're doing. Now, I have an example of my dad. So my dad, there was a time the insurance just became so expensive. Then he did the calculations. He decided to self-insure. You know, he said, and this is my dad, and it's a true story. He said, you know what the fuck? If I get cancer today, I have 10 years to live anyway. This is my dad doing this. He says, I have 10 years probably at my life expectancy. If I get cancer, I'm going to have some 5-6 years. Okay, I'll pay. I'll insure myself. You know?
Yep. And someone is asking in relation to maybe that, what do you, this is, let me see, Khalid, what's your opinion on Nassim Taleb's type of trading, waiting for a black swan once in 10 years?
It's, you know, everyone has their style. I mean,
because you know, I know that you were disagreeing with him on the latest as well, pseudo crash. I think
on the market, market. I don't remember if we disagreed on the market, but we have different, you know, we have different thoughts on this thing. I mean, I'm more Darwinian about it, COVID thing, you know. you know, it's like I try to do the stuff that you're supposed to do, social distancing and all that other jazz. You know, the other day I went to lunch with two people. One of them had COVID, the other one didn't. I made the move so that the guy who had COVID is opposite me next to the other guy, so maximize the distance between me and the third guy. So I've done that. It's worked so far, but I'm not letting it run my life. Meaning if I were to get it, okay, I got it. If I were to die of it, so I die, you know, it wasn't meant to be. I've had a long and fulfilling life. So I'm more a matter of fact about the whole thing than other. And, you know, in the grand scheme of things, like I said, from a statistical perspective, if I'm going to end up being one of the 1%, yeah, so be it. You know, I've been lucky sometimes. I can be unlucky sometimes too.
Yeah, the way you...
So on the markets, Yeah, on the markets, it's different. On the markets, I think I hit it right because, like I said, I did the assessment of the worst case scenario and I didn't see it as that bad because people adjust, you know, people, they, one of the things that, you know, people underestimate, and I'm going to use the word resilience here in the true sense, not the way it's used in Lebanon, the resilience of humanity. And if people adjust, you adjust your life, the technology adjustment, we're much better off today, and so forth, and the way we reacted to the whole thing, the Zoom thing, we carried on our lives, you set up a whole new business. In some ways, you're doing better now than you were before the crisis because the crisis incentivized you to try new shit that you weren't trying because you had this, you were comfortable with the salary being paid by two of the top universities in Lebanon at $1,500 per dollar, right? So in some ways today, you went outside your comfort zone, outside your borders. I mean, I've always said that the PEG made us lazy people, right? Because it paid us a salary so high that we didn't want to, you know, we didn't want to go and seek out the risk. We didn't want to do any of that stuff. And today, I think you, for one, is a prime example of someone who is probably doing better. I think I am somebody, I mean, for example, in the war, the fact that I was a refugee from a town in Beirut, that's very annoying. People got killed in my town. But if this didn't happen, I would have probably ended up my whole life either living in Lebanon or maybe going to the Gulf like my dad did, the GCC, you know, meaning that my, you know, I would have experienced much, much less of the world. Instead, I did a lot of exciting shit that I would have never done had I not been displaced from my home during the war.
True.
If that makes any sense.
Yeah, seeking new opportunities. And you're right, because I either had... Well, this is the thing. You either complain or you seek out new opportunities. George is asking, how can someone predict what the market that the market will still go up yesterday with such a negative NFP report issued yesterday? The indicators are it's the beginning of a recession and should theoretically drive the market down. Add to that Democrats winning both runway, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah, this is a very good question. Nobody can predict what the market is going to do. What you can do is you can have a high conviction about this the path of the market. Okay, so when I was running a trading desk, nobody hit it 100%, and you don't need to hit it 100%. The point of the whole thing is if you can hit it more or much more, you get it right than you get it wrong, and you have limits. And stop orders or stop losses, stop loss orders on your conviction, then you can do well. So the idea isn't about, there's no such thing as you read a report, two reports, and then the market's supposed to behave the way the report does. There's a very simple reason for that. Because if it's true all the time, and if, for example, there's a strategy in investing called the dogs of the Dow. I don't know if you can Google it, you can hear about it. So the dog or the January effect is another one. So the problem with these things is that what happens because if people expect the January effect of the presidential election every time, so what you do is you go in December and you buy, waiting for it, then you by the time it happens, it's too late and it's going to go down. And if there's any anomaly in the market, it disappears because everybody plugs it. That's the whole point of the efficient market theory. So when I was in Colombia, and this is the school of value investing, this is where Warren Buffett went. So the whole idea is that obviously...
And someone asked about that, what you think about value investing. So that would be interesting to tie...
Hey, I come from the school. I mean, I come from the school that is the religion of the school is that. And like I said, Warren Buffett came out of that school. So I kind of believe in it to an extent. But, and even when I was being taught that, they didn't talk about... They just talked about the semi-efficient market. So it's not inefficient and it's not efficient. Semi-efficient. So the idea being is that you can create some advantages, and there's hedge funds that do that all the time. But in general, for most investors, for most people, it's better to just buy the index, a diversified portfolio of an index, and save, save the money. Look, most people get rich not by buying Bitcoin or Tesla or whatever. Most people get rich, and most people don't get rich by inventing an operating system like Microsoft. Okay, or Facebook or whatever. There are a minority of people. If you have a great idea and you execute it, yeah, you'll be a billionaire. But if you're not one of those, there's a better strategy to be a millionaire. And it's basically about being frugal and spending less than you make. It's simple as that. So if you're frugal, meaning at any level of income, whether you make $1,000 a month or $100,000 a month, if you're able to save a chunk of your salary and save it on a regular basis, in a some type of investment strategy which is diversified based on your risk appetite. So if you like risk, you can go into Russell 2000, maybe Wilshire 5000, stuff like that, and minimize bonds. Somebody mentioned talked about ETF. ETFs precisely is what most people should do. So exchange traded fund, that is the Wilshire 5000 in the US, say 40% of your portfolio, another 30% in Europe, another 30% in Asia. And you do that year after year. In the long run, if you wait 20 or 30 years, and you save this, you know, if you save a good chunk of your salary, 20% if you can, 30% if you can, then you're going to do very well in your life within 20 or 30 years. Okay. It's as simple as that. It's very difficult to beat the market as an individual because you are running up against professionals who do this for a living, who have access to much more information that they pay a lot of. Like when I was doing the stuff, I had access to Bloomberg, Reuters. I was paying maybe in those days, $4,000 a month for all access to live feeds and news and stuff. Plus I had access to the flow of clients. And if I know that 90% of my clients are buying euros, you sitting in your house in a basement, you're not going to know that information. I know that the, you know, euro is going to go up because of the disproportionate number of people buying it. So you're going to get your ass kicked by a professional like me. Now, that's not 100% of the time, of course. There are some people talented. The guy who set up the hedge fund Citadel, Ken Griffin, he set it up in his dorm room at the University of Chicago and invented, I think he was the one that invented convertible arbitrage, the strategy about buying, you know, convertible bonds and looking at the anomalies there.
Yeah, and in relation to this, do you think Sherbil is asking? Don't you think with everyone buying into ETFs and index funds that we're on the verge of a passive investing bubble?
Yeah, good question. I don't like, for example, I notice I never said S&P 500. I never said Dow Jones, except to give the example of the dogs of the Dow. So I agree that the reason I mentioned the Wilshire 5000, most of you on this call probably haven't heard of the Wilshire 5000. That's the index that if you want to buy an index fund, that's the one I like, because it's so big that it's not as tracked as the S&P 500. See, S&P 500, they can play with it because a lot of fund managers get measured against the S&P 500. So therefore, they have to emulate a whole portion of it. And the way they beat the S&P 500 is by saying, okay, out of the 600 stocks or whatever in S&P 500, I'm going to, you know, I like this one, I don't like this one, I like this one, I don't like this one. So you go in and you pick what you think are winners and you get out of the ones you think are losers, right? That's how you do it. With the Wilshire 5000, it's so big. And of course, there's some arbitrage moments when the rebalancing happens, like a stock goes in, stock goes out. So the Wilshire 5000, less tracked, I like it. Russell 2000, same thing. I like it for young people or people that like risk. And instead of buying Tesla, I would buy something like the Russell 2000. I don't mean now, it's a bit expensive. Like that trade I did more than doubled, by the way. But that's an unusual thing. Again, you know, happened to hit the bottom of the market recovered, there was a bit of luck involved, but nevertheless, it's clear I had a conviction. You could see, in fact, I think I used the word conviction at the time.
Is it Halim, I think, did you endorse Dream's Bitcoin tweet or something? You, Dan?
His FOMO tweet, you mean?
I retweeted
retweets are not endorsements.
are you into crypto? So the question is that?
No, I'm not a crypto guy. I've got an article. You can look at it on my website or Nahar or whatever. It's called Exorbitant Privilege. I have a very specific idea on how currencies work. Okay. And my definition of what a currency is very simple. I look at it, I define it in this article. It's a claim on GDP. Okay. And a lira, Lebanese lira, will always buy you a piece of the Lebanese GDP. Okay. Yeah. A Japanese yen will buy you a piece of the Japanese GDP and so on. So the thesis of this article is if you close up every country to the world, you build the Trump wall and everything, except you prevent people coming in and out. So what does a lira buy you? Okay, it doesn't. You know, we can't import any more cars, right? We're done. We're back to donkeys. donkeys become very expensive because there's not a lot of them. We'll start breeding those. We may even not be able to eat because we import a lot of our food, right? Japanese, would they be able to sell cars? You remember, they import steel. So they can't even manufacture cars in Japan. So who are the countries? Which are the countries that are self-sustaining, whereby a claim on GDP will always have value? It's basically, there's only two or three countries like that that are close to being self-sustaining. You got the United States, maybe Canada, you know, a couple others, maybe. So what happens if nobody takes the dollar anymore? If the whole world says, you know what, fuck you, Trump, we don't like you. We're not going to take the dollar anymore. Because today, what happens today? Today, what happens today is that a Japanese person takes a piece of metal that he imports, steel, and then he molds it into a car, right? A Toyota, and then he puts in leather seats and computer chips and an engine for 300 horsepower engine and all that other jazz, right? Paints it and then sells it to an American. And what does the American give him in return? He gives them pictures of dead presidents, right?
Yes, and I heard the argument. I'll let you continue, but yes, so this is important to discuss with regards to the dollar now that everyone is freaking
okay.
out and whatnot.
So that's what they get. You get a pieces of paper with a dollar. That's it. So you now remember, it's a fantastic deal. Imagine you. I don't know if I did this the last time, because this is one of my favorite topics. I talk about this all the time. Imagine you and me, Professor Resmi, we go to a restaurant and we buy the Lubia caviar and meat and steak and all this jazz. And at the end of the day, you know, at the end, they give us the bill. And you tell them, 1 second, you take out your printer and you print these pictures of you and me. These, and you give them a 200, you know, 200 rasmis for the food. It's a fucking great deal if you can pull it off, right? So that is the value of the dollar. Now, if people realize one day, okay, remember what a dollar does. So a dollar can buy you shit from anywhere in the world. It can make people behave in ways they don't want to behave, right? If you know what I mean. Yeah. And it's a great deal, and that's called exorbitant privilege. This wasn't invented, that word, by me, even though the article is called exorbitant privilege. That word was invented by, some people say, General de Gaulle, some people say Valéry Giscard d'Estaing in the 70s. This is when they went off Bretton Woods. So effectively, if the world says to the Americans, we're not going to do this anymore, so what is an American going to do? Okay, first problem that the Japanese and the Chinese and all those guys have is they have these trillions of paper already. What are they going to do with it? So remember, the American is not going to be sold anymore Toyotas. So what does he do? He goes and buys Chevrolets and Pontiacs, right? No televisions, fine. They know how to manufacture them. They have the technology. And the American is this. The example I like to give is like your domestic helper. You know how to do dishes. You know how to do dishes, right? But you hire a domestic helper in Lebanon to do your dishes for you. The idea being that you want to free up your free time. You have more money than she does. So you want to free up your free time to study Plato and Aristotle, right? Something more cerebral. That's why you get her to do the dishes. So
something which is useless.
You outsource. So you outsource or whatever. You can, you know, you want to play poker, whatever. So you're outsourcing, effectively, you're outsourcing stuff that is, in your opinion, more medial and affordable. Now, when an American buys a Toyota from the Japanese, okay, or he outsources the components. Remember, the iPhone is made in America, but the components are made in Taiwan and Korea and all these other places. But that is the domestic helper equivalent for an American. They know how to make that shit. They are outsourcing it. And if these guys give them a lot of trouble, they know how to make it themselves. It might, you know, it's same thing with dishes for you. The first couple of times you're going to break dishes when you do it, right? You may not do it as fast as the domestic helper, but eventually it'll be okay and you'll do it. So same way with the Americans. So the Americans have the ability to self-sustain that no other country has. And that's where the value of the dollar comes in from, in my opinion.
And in relation to that, there's a question about...
Sorry. One more thing. Yeah. What are they going to do with the trillions of dollars that the Japanese and Chinese have? So remember, they said, we're not going to take any more dollars. So what are they going to do with all that paper they have?
Buy stuff from the U.S. or something?
From the U.S. only. Because remember, yep. They've all agreed they're going to cut off the U.S. So yep. Now you got 4 trillion U.S. Now the U.S. can do a couple of things here. The U.S. can say, you know what? I'm not going to let these fucking foreigners buy any land or property in the U.S. And I don't want you to buy my stock market. Kind of like the Chinese do. And they had this thing called QFII. QFII. They don't allow foreigners to buy a lot. They give them a quota. So the U.S. can do the same, right? So now you got these trillions of paper overseas that you can't even spend anywhere. They're worthless to you, right?
Yeah.
Or if the US wants to be nice, they'll tell you you can buy our Chevrolets, right?
True.
You get my drift?
Yeah. But so...
So this is called, by the way, there's a name for this. It's called the dollar trap.
And how did we even get there, right? So because so many questions about metals and gold. So in relation to that, would you, because I've even heard the argument from other investors, some people don't even like investing in gold or metals or whatever that is, because it doesn't have any, between brackets, intrinsic value in a sense. It's
correct.
Just
that's me. Something that's which me. Is... It's the value investing Warren Buffett approach. Same thing. I'm going to give you can read his books to hear the same thing. But effectively, the value of gold is basically derived from what you feel it is. A lot of people talk about scarcity value and stuff like that, but in reality, gold, to a large extent, the usage gold is a fad. There was a time in Lebanon, for example, when every man, to show that he's rich, he would wear a plaque, a gold plaque here, a big chain, a gold chain, usually with a cross or Quran or whatever, right? This was very, very common, 20 years ago, whatever. And in India, they give gold, and even in Lebanon, when you get engaged, part of it is you have to give a whole bunch of gold to the bride or the bride-to-be, right? So there's a whole cultural component of it, which is symbolic of wealth. And it has value as long as you believe it has value. But in reality, I come from a school where you price something based on the cash it spits out. Yani, if you look at a coffee shop, for example, as an investment, and you look at the net income of the coffee shop and say it gives out $100,000 a year, then I might pay, in Lebanon, I might pay, and I look at the revenue, is it consistent? Was it 90 last year, 80 the year before? I look at the occupancy, you do all this assessment. If it looks like it's a sustainable income, then I might pay $500,000 for it, okay? So gold doesn't produce any of that stuff for you to be able to price it. Gold is basically, you when you buy gold or stuff like gold, you're saying basically, I think it's going to go up. Why do you think it would go up? Oh, inflation is coming. U.S. is printing too much money. You might have some type of a thesis behind it, but that's what it's about. So this is a business that makes money from your projection of its path in the future. Nothing more, nothing less.
But what do you say then when it comes to the very concept of cash or currency? So you're tying it with or to the income that this generates, or the cash flows that any business endeavor generates. But I've heard this argument from Saifuddin and those who are pro Bitcoin, that their currency as such is not what hard money, or I forgot what he calls it. So it's as whimsical, no? And this, yes, is why he prefers gold, because gold, and the Bitcoin argument, limited supply, and then you can properly determine the value of it, etc.
Yes, I don't know. I get their argument. I mean, there's a big difference between Bitcoin as a store of value and gold. Gold has a track record behind it. So yeah. There's also differences between these two things. Plus, it has some usages. And it has some actual usages in some components, parts of stuff, right? That's where the similarity between Bitcoin and gold stops. Okay?
and it's shiny.
Somebody said, it's shiny. Jack said, precisely, it's shiny. It's pretty, it's pretty. It can help you with a date. It can help you get engaged in India, for example.
And the decentralization approach as well, because in Lebanon, we are fucked because of that, no?
No, but the decentralization is precisely the weakness of something like Bitcoin. Okay, because I'll tell you why. Well, you're underestimating the term full faith and credit of the United States, right? So I'll give you an example. If the U.S. today says to you, okay, remember, in the end, when you want to transact in Bitcoin, at some node, you need to convert it to U.S. dollars or a currency to buy shit, right? You can't buy a Manushi with Bitcoin, right? Right. So if the U.S. today says to you, okay, Bitcoin is a conduit for money laundering, and bans it, what happens? It's a simple statement, just like that.
I do get the question, but isn't this kind of what some people are said Bitcoin could be used for. So it's not something that is new. But then if they...
I got you. But if a law is passed, right now the US is...
As a law, it would be fucked. Like it. Yeah.
So you have a case here where you're assuming that the thing that's going to displace the dollar as the world currency can in one, you know, can in one stroke of a pen be by the same currency be displaced in 1 second, right? Now, pretty clearly, the U.S. at this point in time has made an assessment that the technological benefits from allowing this stuff to flourish is more important than the threat that they pose, right?
Yeah.
Remember, there's over 1,000 of these things, and they could have benefits, but the issue there is that there's that. So Bitcoin, like gold, not unlike gold in this case, is the price is derived from what people think it's going to be derived. You know, there are some people that are very fanatically believing in it. So obviously, it can go up to 100,000. But the issue there is that you must remember today. I mean, you could see when bubbles build, right? How do you know this? When people get into stuff that normally they don't know what it is. They don't know what blockchain means. Okay, they don't know what Bitcoin means. They don't know what cryptography is. They don't know what a digital currency is, yet they are buying or want to buy Bitcoin, right? I've seen this. I mean, this happens. This shit happens all the time. I saw it in .com boom. They bought, you know, I had friends of my dad. They're like, I want to buy some semiconductor stock. And I'm like, Dad, you know what semiconductor is? No, but my friends are saying, you know. By the way, did you see that in 2015, there was a company called Long Island Iced Tea. Google it. They changed the name to Blockchain Long Island Iced Tea or something like that because stock price quadrupled in one day.
I do get that. Like speculators always might or will and FOMOs and those would fuck the market up. But take for example, let's say Venezuela's economy or now Lebanese economy, because this is where I want a segue into Lebanon a bit. This maybe has been helpful for people who wanted to, you know, be able to do some sort of transactions or store value in Bitcoin, you know, because they didn't have any other option.
So I'm with you.
Yeah, you always have these two strands of people who are speculating and people who use it because this is their way out, kind of way.
It's not a way out. Your daughters are in the bank.
No, for people right. who took their money out. And مثلاً for now, some people want to pay me in Bitcoin. So I ended up with Bitcoin, right? And this is one way of doing transactions. So for me, it's been also helpful, not because I'm interested in investing in Bitcoin. It's just I ended up with X amount of Bitcoin now because they wanted to pay me in Bitcoin.
Yeah, that's fine. Their choice and your choice. If you know, obviously, if you're happy, they're happy. Everybody's happy. But the point is that, you know, Bitcoin as a way out today of people that have LOLAR stuck in the bank, obviously it's too late, the solution to that problem is the same then or now. Like they could have been, instead of a Lebanese bank, they could have been in Bitcoin or they could have been in real dollars. And in both cases, they would have been, you know, they would have been out. Had Bitcoin collapsed, they would have lost money. And being Bitcoin rallied instead, they made more money than a pure US dollar. That's a different thing.
The concept is losses, you know, we always want to win. Well, sometimes you have to incur losses because sometimes you're just fucked. No?
Yeah. So it's a speculative thing. There's nothing wrong with speculation. Remember, a lot of funds, a lot of investors, that they do what's called momentum investing. Momentum investing is when you buy something because you have a conviction it's going to go up. You don't have an opinion on it being worth what it's going up to. In fact, you probably think it's overvalued, but you buy it anyway because this is back to that second order, third order analysis. If I believe that everyone is going to buy Bitcoin and that Bitcoin is going to go up, I can make money even though I think it's overvalued. You get my drift? So there's a chunk of people in the Bitcoin investment community is divided into two parts. There are the ideological types who believe Bitcoin is going to be the future, and that's an ideological investment. And then there's a lot of people, the FOMO types. This is what Mahmoud talked about, which is the fact that, you know, fear of missing out. Yep. They got in because, and I've seen this. I see the sister of a friend of mine just bought Bitcoin. I mean, that's part of what's driving the rally. I got a friend of mine who lost a lot of money in LOLARs. Now he's trying to make it up by going into Bitcoin. You know what I mean?
And in relation to that, I've had several questions about Lebanon. So I'll throw them at you and you tackle the situation however you want, but or the question. First, as a, so what do you think about real estate? Someone asked. And many others are talking, are asking about, my cat is interested in the talk, are asking about the dollar rate and if in relation to what Riyad Salemi mentioned yesterday. And, you know, okay, so, real estate, gold, the central bank, Lebanon.
Yalla. So real estate, basically, it's not an escape. I've got a, my Hummus Economics episode 3 is about real estate. So you can go watch it. It'll tell you in detail what I think of that and why I think it's not a great place to escape to. Okay. Gold, we talked about gold. Riyad Salemi's statement yesterday, I think, look, the problem with Riyad Salemi's statement the other day, people, this is why I did a tweet on it right after it came out. It created a whole big panic. People thought he had said something new, that the
Yes, Finance even agreed and that this is a first, because he hadn't said that publicly before.
Leb Finance even? Yani it's like Leb Finance even?
Hey,
even. Leb Finance even?
Yes, because you seem to agree on a lot of things. This is why he never takes stances like that. But
I don't think there was anything new in the statement. I'll tell you what was new. Okay, look, what the fuck? And you're trading the lira at 9,000, man. You need Riyad Salemi to come out and tell you it's floating. It's fucking floating.
It's floating. But when they actually take proper measures for it to become, because they can maintain
what the measures? Market. He didn't say any measures. He just said that the days of a peg is gone. You needed him to fucking tell you that after it's been gone for a year and 2 months.
Yeah, but I think people are more worried or not worried. Maybe they're thinking in terms of maybe now if the banks are going to be floating it, then we will get our dollars at 8,000 or something, you know.
So there was a misunderstanding of the statement. The statement that what this is my point I made. The statement was he was saying an aphorism, a very obvious thing. He was saying that the peg is finished, which everybody
we all knew that. Yeah.
Okay. That's what he said. And he said something else. He said that the peg will be officially removed once the IMF comes in. Again, something we all know. But people, that second part was misreported. So people assumed that he's going to remove the peg on the remaining items, yani loans at 1500 or whatever, tomorrow morning, yani today. That's the misunderstanding that happens. And that's the reason I did my tweet saying he said nothing new, because it created a panic. The dollar rate went up yesterday. People were trying to buy dollars. So I was trying to tell them, look, he didn't say anything new. Here's the problem with Riyad Salemi. For the last 27, 28 years, he's been treated so deferentially, like a god in his interviews. Most of his interviews were with local stations. And as you know, the stations were treating him like a saint. So he's not used to people, the foreign media, trying to trap him. So if you remember, there was an interview he did with a foreign station. The interview started, "Are you a criminal?" I mean, this guy is not used to being asked in an interview, which opens with, "Are you a criminal?" Right? In this case, this guy was trying to do it in a bit more implicitly. And he did his research, and he tried to trap him in certain things. You got to remember his English. He's a very eloquent speaker, but his English is not as good as his Arabic. His Arabic when he does interviews is impeccable. So sometimes he'll be caught. So regardless, the problem is there. In cases like this in the past, they kind of, he was forgiven. And they forgave stuff which was abstract or was obscure or vague. Today, they grabbed onto it and started reporting. Okay. This is not good for, for people like us, the Lebanese, because when you hear something like this, you think something changed. Okay, so this type of reporting, sensation reporting, is good for clicks. It's good for, it created the whole sensation. It was being reported, the views, etc. But for an average Lebanese listening to this stuff, the average Lebanese thought something major had changed, and nothing major had changed. Okay, the guy basically said that the lira peg is gone, and we will officially do it when the IMF negotiations happen. It's a very, this is something very, very well known. It's known.
Of course, but for maybe now, if the question would be just like in the Argentina case, what will happen to the money stuck in banks? Because the Argentine government tried to pacify the pacification of the deposits, but 4 years later, they were obliged, from what I read, it was deemed illegal to do that. So in our case, what happened? Like, the money is gone, of course, but what will happen? Is it going to stay at 3,900? Are they going to be
leaving it? Yeah. It depends on who's doing the payment. Look, there's two paths here. There's the path. Riyad Salem has a plan. He's told you already. And you got to listen to the guy. He's already told you what he's going to do. He's already said that you're in Lebanon. He said that to Bassam Abu Zaid, right? He said, you're in Lebanon. Why are you expecting your money in dollars? We'll give it to you in lira. So he's already told you he's going to give you your money in lira. Simple as that.
Yeah.
That's it. Right. Halla. On the other hand, there's the IMF. If the IMF comes in, they're not going to allow this jazz. They don't like the lira, what's called lirification. So if the IMF comes in, they're going to do the bail-in thing. Okay. Halla. There's also an in-between thing, which is I've been advocating. So bail-in is unavoidable if the IMF comes in or in the international community, the Europeans get involved. If they don't come in, dollar deposits as of November are 112 billion.
You cut out for like 30 seconds.
Okay, so the lirification policy in some sense in a Darwinian way has been working. So deposits have dropped from almost 180 billion. The last report I saw, it's dropped below 140 billion. Okay. The dollar portion is now 112 billion. So in a Darwinian way, loans are 22 billion. Bank loans in dollars are 22 billion. So what's happening is the shrinking, people getting haircuts on themselves, running into real estate, etc. So the whole liability is going smaller and smaller and smaller as we speak. So Riyad Salem's plan is very simple. He's going to keep giving it to you in lira like this while the problem resolves itself with this voluntary haircut that you're doing on yourself. Every time you withdraw at 3,900, you're taking a 60% haircut, right? Or you sell the account or whatever. Yani, kill all the haircuts. So this is his plan. If the IMF comes in, the IMF will do it in a bit more organized. What the IMF will do is they'll say, okay, 85% of you will get your money back. 85% of deposits will get their money back, probably in dollars to the last penny. And then the losses will be on the top people and they'll compensate them via a bail-in, shares in the bank, partially. And if we're lucky, they'll do what I want to do, which is clawback of the people that ran away in the year and a half that they avoided capital controls. So that's the, in my opinion, that's the equitable solution or distribution of losses. And you avoid the bottom 85% from getting any loss. And then the top people, depending on how much money they had, how much interest they got, how much fake interest, etc. And you compensate them partly by getting some of the money back. And who's the one that escaped, masalan, Arkif? Who escaped in the last year and a half when they stopped capital controls? That's an important question. So you try to get some of that money back.
And which would have been maybe resolved, as you were saying at the beginning, with a simple haircut. But then we like to complicate things. Someone also is asking about, because you mentioned something, Abdu Khoury, you mentioned psychology of trading somehow earlier and the efficient or semi-efficiency of markets. Have you tried muting all fundamentals and just looking at technical analysis? I know this is a bit off topic, but I wanted to ask that.
Who, me?
Yeah.
I haven't done that because, the issue is maybe it's better than what I'm doing, but what I'm doing has worked for me. I can afford to buy the cigar, so I don't need to do it. And it never fuck with a plan that's working.
Never fuck with a plan that's working. And let me see if any Bitcoin can be viewed as a hedge against many things: inflation, financial collapse of financial system, even nuclear war, which is something that is very curious when it comes to the mentality, even of Lebanese.
I'm not sure. It's a hedge against nuclear war. I mean, if you look at EMP, I mean, the computers would stop and data is erased. So I don't think it's a hedge against nuclear war by any stretch.
Unless it's like one part is bombed, it's all over the place.
Yeah, there's computers all over the world, so there's gonna be a reduction in the, so I don't think it's a hedge against nuclear weapons by any means. In fact, gold might be. And I know people that are, really wealthy. They always like to have these guys are smarter than me. They like to have something like 5% of their stuff in gold. And I have some rich Jewish friends, and they will always have 5% in gold, for example, because they've been through World War II. They've been through that stuff when the Germans, the Holocaust and all that stuff, and what, whatever they had in gold and precious metals was the difference between them surviving or not surviving. So I can respect a point of view of having 5% of your portfolio in stuff like that, precious metal, gold, etc. But as an inflation hedge, it's not. Look, when you think about what inflation is, what is inflation? It's an increase in prices of products. So if you own a stock of a company that sells shoes, the prices increase of the shoes. If you own a REIT, real estate investment trust, or if you own an apartment building with rent, then that's an inflation hedge to a large extent, right? Because the rents increase, and so on. You know what I mean? So I'm not, in the long run, stocks are an inflation hedge. And if you look at the data over the last 70, 80 years, it definitely holds that view. There's also other inflation hedges like TIPS. There are bonds that are like in the US and the UK have them that are that have an inflation component in them.
Yeah. And so I'll continue with these questions, and we'll maybe wrap it up with Lebanon again with regards to ways out. But someone is asking, since the U.S. market is inflated today, where do you advise someone with fresh money to invest?
That's a very good question. You're right. It is inflated. And if you had a lot of cash today, would I go into the U.S. market? Absolutely not. I wouldn't. But if you are a young person in your 20s, I don't know what the demography of your audience is today, but if you're a young person in your 20s, I would just, I would put into ETFs all over the world. I would put in a certain amount every month on a regular basis. Like I said, when I was in my 20s working, I did that. It worked very, very nicely for me. And I recommend it for other people, even if the market is inflated. If you're putting the same amount every month, it's fine. You don't try to time the market. But if you have a lot of cash right now, yes, of course, I wouldn't put it in the US market right this second.
When you say gold, do you mean gold stock through mining companies or actual gold as commodity?
That's an interesting question. So one guy told me the other day that Warren Buffett bought Barrick Gold, which is a gold mining company. And so Warren Buffett must like gold. I'm like, no, Barrick Gold isn't gold. Barrick Gold is a company that mines for gold. And what Warren Buffett likes is the efficiency and the way the companies run and the way it produces this product, which could have been shoes, but it happens to be gold. So he's not buying gold. He's buying a gold company. Very different. It's like him buying Coke versus Pepsi. He's not betting on soda. He's betting on Coke. You know what I mean? So the answer to your question is, look, if a nice way to do the gold thing is, if you're married, for example, okay, and, you want to buy a Christmas present, Mahmoud, for your wife, okay, there's a couple of things you can buy. You can buy her a jacket, which is really expensive, and then it'll be worthless in a year or two. She'll probably wear it twice. Or you can buy her a nice gold bracelet. So one way to invest in gold is to gift your wife, instead of perishable shit, gold or whatever, stuff like that.
Halim said.
So the answer to your question is, if you're gonna buy gold, you probably want to just buy the physical.
60-40 portfolio too conservative for someone who wants to retire in 15 years?
No, it's very personal. You have to look at, they do this, good banks will do a risk assessment of you. You need to know your risk appetite. Every person is different. Some people like to take more risk than others. Yani, people that are very risk-seeking, okay, usually, by the way, these are the people that really do the best, okay? And it's not for everyone. Not everyone can do that. Yani, I'm not, for example, an extreme guy with regard to risk, but I do like risk. And generally speaking, it's proportional to reward. So the more risk you take, the more reward there is. However, there's also the ability to sleep well at night. So if you're a conservative person, you want to retire in 15 years, yes, generally 60-40 is a good mix. However, the problem with bonds today is the yield is so low that it's going to be very painful for you. And that's the whole point, by the way, of why interest rates are so low. What the central banks all over the world are doing are they're trying to tell you take more risk to move the economy or whatever. So they're trying to seduce you into taking more risk because of the low payouts.
Okay. So many questions. Sorry if I don't ask them all, but then Brookfield is betting on the property sector. Would you buy the dip in the property sector now? That's a very...
I have a fund, Dana, which is a real estate property fund. Yeah, it's got commercial properties and apartment rentals, strip malls, stuff like that. The problem with the property sector now, because of COVID, there's a lot of danger. Yeah, you got to be careful about this dip because you got to remember that today, there's a lot of pressure. There's a lot of less need for office space, right? So we need to figure out how this COVID thing is going to develop. Will, for example, the idea of us working from home become more popular in the future? Will universities start teaching more the way they're doing now, etc.? You know what I mean? So I would be careful about the dip. Whenever you assess an investment, do it all the time via the cash flow. Yani, if you want to buy property, let's say you want to buy a building, you look at the building, you look at the occupancy rate, you look at the leases that they have, you look at the track record, you look at the trend, what's going on, you look at how much rent they're paying, what your expenses are. So what the NOI, net operating income, is, you divide that by the price, you get the cap rate. If the cap rate is attractive, then that's a good investment. So I hate the way Lebanese look at real estate. Lebanese people always buy a piece of land because it's going to double. You know yes. what I'm saying? It's like the dumbest way of doing it. I'm going to tell you a secret. 99% of real estate professionals in Lebanon, ask them this question, do the test. Ask them, what does NOI mean? They'll tell you, what's NOI? Tell them net operating income. They won't know. Tell them, what does cap rate mean, capitalization rate? They won't know. 99% of professional real estate investors in Lebanon that have been doing it for 20 years don't know what those concepts are. And those are the number one concepts for assessing the value of real estate.
And in relation to all this, investments and ways out, because even Carlos Gosson spoke about this, the valuation of the assets that we have, and then what would be, someone asked this question, what would be a way out for Lebanon, considering that a lot of the raw material we have to import? Right. So is it only many are focusing on tech, saying, well, you know, or startups or whatever? How can we become productive in a way that would actually take us out of this shithole in the long run?
Look, I'm a big fan of Carlos Hosson. In fact, I was at a conference in Paris about 2 weeks before he was arrested. It was a Columbia event. And he's a marvelous speaker, very credible guy. In automotive science and running an automotive company. I'm a big fan, I'm a big admirer of his. But خليه يسمح لنا. يعني his talking about this stuff is as ludicrous as me telling him how to run Nissan. Sometimes we extrapolate نحنا skill set in a certain area. This reminds me of Qard al-Hassan مثلا. They extrapolated because you saw the big mistake they made in the thing, right? So people extrapolate. If you're good at one thing, it means you're good at everything. It's not the case. In fact, Carlos himself owns 5% of a local bank. He's on the board of a bank. And we know what happened to that bank. So يعني his performance in areas outside the automotive has not been very exemplary, is that if I want to be frank about it. You know, the bank that he was on the board of, he didn't see the crisis coming pretty clearly. You can pick up the minutes of what he said or didn't say about it. So now after the fact, doing an analysis saying that the exaggerated assessment of ABL of 40 billion, he thinks it's too low. I mean, I was at the talk when he was calling Tesla overvalued. Of course, things can be, you know, the market can be wrong longer than you can be solvent. So he called it overvalued in the summer of, I can't remember, it's 2019 or 2018. I can't remember. So obviously it had a big run up. So the valuation of something, yani the psychological valuation of something is different from the actual value of something. Okay. Yani the price somebody's willing to pay is different from anything else. But the most important thing is that the price of these things that he's talking about, the assets of the government, is not really relevant to the crisis. You know, I mean, what is he saying? We're going to sell Lebanon to foreigners and get dollar cash to compensate depositors earning Ponzi interest?
Or it's attracting not in any maybe bank. In a way investments, because then how can we be more productive as such?
Yeah, investment in what? We got plenty of hotels, we got plenty of restaurants, we got plenty of everything. What exactly do we offer someone to come in here and invest in the country?
So what do you think?
The only thing we have, I think it's let's just say it was a very pretty speech that just is
no, no, but like when it comes to being productive, like what can we as Lebanon, yeah, as entrepreneurs now, between brackets, who want to be, how can we become a productive economy?
We don't know. We have to find ourselves. Yani it's about a chaotic type of evolution of individual effort evolving independently, chaotically, of self-improvement. Yani what you just did, for example, if I told you 3 years ago that you'd be doing this as a business,
I think we need to clarify what I do, because now they would think like I'm some sort of millionaire or something. I just offer philosophy online, or a philosophy course.
Yes, but
online.
It's where is. Yeah, I know, but it's if you tried to sell this to investors as a business model 3 years ago.
Oh yeah.
Think about it. If you went to investors saying, "I think I'm going to set up a business selling philosophy." Okay, so, but it's worked for you. You did something crazy and it's starting to work, right?
Which I still don't understand, but it's working, yes.
Yeah, so there's a lot of people like you doing exactly the same thing. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So what happens here is if you're good at what you do, you have a passion and you follow it and you do it. So there's a lot of people right now doing precisely what you're doing. And the average, weighted average of all these hundreds and thousands of people trying to survive, by the way, this is not about you changing the world. This is about you trying to support your family. Same thing with all the other Lebanese trying to do the same type of shit, right? So this is what it's about. Where we get to, I don't know. Did anybody guess that Korea, after World War, after the Korean War, did anyone guess that there would be some of the best-selling cars and phones in the world? Of course not. They were behind us in those days. So nobody can guess what the competitive advantage is going to be of a country, what the unique selling proposition is. We don't know what that is. But to come in and say, oh, we got nice mountains and they're worth much more than, you know, the exaggerated view of it, it's just the bullshit. We don't know what it is we have. It's probably something along the lines of selling thoughts, because we're not going to create factories that are competitive. We're not going to create cars that compete with BMW. Not likely. Possible, but not likely. You know what I mean? We're not going to be building something to compete with Boeing and Airbus. Okay? That ain't going to happen. We're not going to build a phone that competes with Samsung. So where is our competitive advantage? We have an idea. Movies. Okay? We make some of the best movies in the Arab world. Media, singers.
That might be exaggerated a bit, but okay.
Chuhiye.
The movies part.
And the Arab world. I said Arab world.
I would go for probably Egyptian. They have industries.
But Egyptian, remember that you have to look at it proportionally to the population. It's not just the number, the absolute number. Proportionally to the population, we are very good at the stuff. Fashion. We are very good. We don't just have one guy, two guys, three guys. We have a lot of people that have done very well in fashion all over the world. So pretty clear we have certain talent here that might break out, right? You know, the fact that MTV and LBC and our stations are transmitted all over the Arab world. Remember, it's not a Yemeni station that's transmitted. It's not an Omani station transmitted all over the world, right? It's a Lebanese station. And remember that those are not very well funded. Yeah, it's all about talent. Remember, there's a lot of countries that throw a lot of money. And when you throw a lot of money at something, you can create a formidable force. But I'm talking about stations that just built themselves up into, remember, LBC was set up in 1986 in the middle of the Lebanese War, right?
Yeah.
So it went, it became an international phenomenon. So we have the MTV, same thing. We have, it was closed for a long time and then it opened and did well. So we do have certain talent in media, in we used to have it in writing. Maybe we can get that back in newspapers, etc. In fact, you see what I'm saying? In fact, a lot of the media companies in the Arab world are being run by Lebanese too. If you look at the, you know, announcers, if you look at the CEOs, etc. So there are some areas where we, you know, those could be the future of the country.
And
advertising, communication, a lot of stuff like that.
Yeah, but we'll start wrapping it up again. When it comes to that, this is the narrative that we're selling. Instead of maybe being productive and selling it from Lebanon, it's the narrative that is being sold, and this is a. Like we try to tell Lebanese or the entire, why did they thrive abroad? Well, because they have an environment where they can actually thrive abroad. The question here is, how can we get people to thrive here? Like all Lebanese who go outside, or many of them, they thrive because the conditions are there, because there's a proper system put in place, et cetera, et cetera.
I'm gonna give you another reason. That you may not like. Yani, let's take you as an example. When the lira was at 1500 and you were teaching at two of the top universities in Lebanon, LAU and AUB, right? You were getting a pretty nice fucking salary, right? Your biggest ambition at the time was maybe to get a tenure track at one of them, right? And then become tenured professor. So in many ways, the fact that maybe it's not for you, but on average, on average, that's a correct statement. So you were making so much money, not you, but a guy like you, that you didn't think of this interesting new path that you did. Now, when you left one of them, or you were asked to leave or whatever.
I was fired from LEU, and then I quit AUB after the devaluation of the lira, because my salary became $400.
Right. Or something. But what did that give you? That gave you the freedom to pursue something that you wouldn't have dared to pursue, because the opportunity cost was simply too high. Your wife would have divorced you. Like, fuck you. You're going to quit that job making that much money to go and try selling philosophy online? Are you fucking crazy? I'm going back to Argentina, she would have said to you, right? So in some ways, it freed you up to do interesting shit. Yani, the same thing with me. What did I do? I used to work in, before banking, I used to work in command control systems and information systems, computer science, computer programming, shit like this, right? I decided to change that completely. Went and did my MBA, then became a Wall Street guy, banker, you know, did pretty well. Then I stopped, and now what do I do now? I decided to get into media. I mean, what the fuck do I know about media? What do I have to do with media?
You have YouTube channel now.
Yeah, but the freedom, what allows me to do that? It's the same freedom that allows you to do what you're doing. Yani, we have different reasons why we feel we are free to do this, right? But it's the same result. So freedom allows you to let your brain explore new shit, new interesting shit that might be more or less lucrative, but it's certainly more fun. Like, whether you end up being a millionaire because of what you're doing or not, you're having a lot of fun doing it in any event. Much more fun than when you were locked up in the confines of LAU and AUB.
True. And I promise now, one last question, because I saw this before today on Twitter. What do you think of this such... ventures, let's put it this way, like the new cooperative that and AUB, some of AUB people were talking about. It's called, I think, Shriek. It's like a cooperative.
Look,
literally, it's a bank, but not a bank. You know, I don't know. What do you think about that?
It's a credit union.
Basically, credit union. That's how he explained it. You know.
By the way, there's an article, I was interviewed on this by I think they're called Triangle on this about a year ago. So I've talked about this stuff before, credit unions. I mean, credit unions have a have a place in society. That, yani, sometimes what we try to do is we try to come in and say, okay, we're going to solve a problem by ignoring it or whatever. Yani, we have a problem in the banking sector. The banking sector has to be reformed, has to be restructured. We can't avoid that regardless. Now, is there a place for credit unions in Lebanon? Maybe, but we are already overcrowded with banking.
Because so, he said it's risk-free. This is what got people worried about it. It's like, what does risk-free okay, even mean in this case?
The term risk-free was, he shouldn't have said that, and it's a mistake to say that. Whoever said that shouldn't have said that, okay? There's no such thing as risk-free. In fact, whenever somebody tells you risk-free, and it's not a U.S. Treasury...
Run away.
But other than that, let's assume that was just a slip of the tongue. The concept of a credit union is fine. I have an account at a credit union. It's fine. You get certain things that are cheaper than banks because you're part owner, so they tend to have advantages, but also they tend to have disadvantages. Like, they're not as competent in certain specialized fields. So it depends. I'm talking about the world, you know, the global experience of this thing. But more importantly, you can't have 60 banks and then say, I'm going to set up 10 credit unions, right?
Yeah.
The idea is we need in Lebanon maybe 10 banks total. So whether those 10 banks are 10 banks and, you know, 8 banks and 2 credit unions, or 5 banks and 5 credit unions, or 10 credit unions or 10 banks, you can't just make it now that we have 65 banking type institutions. That's what I have to say on that topic.
Any oil and gas? I just saw that. Any oil and gas opinion, comment? Not necessarily. Okay, not so Lebanon market in general.
Let me talk about the Lebanon part.
Okay.
Just in case that's what it's about. Yeah. So in Lebanon, I wrote an article called the Curse of Oil and Gas. You can read it to know what I think on that topic. But the real quick summary is this. We haven't found any oil and gas in Lebanon. We have not found one drop. So there is, at this point in time, the probability of us finding oil and gas is something like 38%. Okay. If we find oil and gas, the first dollar would come in 7 to 10 years. If the first dollar comes in and they don't steal it, it'll be something like $1, maybe $2 billion a year. So it's not a game changer. But more importantly than that, oil and gas in no country in the world has it been a positive effect on the country, except one country. In every country in the world, either it created massive problems, war, corruption, etc. Zakia said Norway. She's right. Norway is the only country that was very successful with its oil and gas. And the reason it was successful with oil and gas is because it ignored it. It basically saved it. So they have a sovereign wealth fund that basically every family is a millionaire in Norway because of this. Okay. So the other problem for us, Lebanon, we already had oil and gas. It was expats. Expats was that oil and gas. And what did we do? We blew it. And we had the Dutch disease, which is a very common thing. What's called the resource curse of oil means that you become lazy because of oil. And in my article, I talk about that specifically, what I mean by that. But the idea is that we used the expat savings as our oil in the past. So it made us lazy. It made us spend their money. It made us less productive. So again, back to the example, the reason you didn't do what you did now is because you were being overpaid for what you did, okay, in the past, that you had too much opportunity cost for you to take the risk and go and follow your dream or follow something that's exciting and new.
Do that, and they're being now, they are still being overpaid because they need to maintain the ranking and shit like that. What about that's just take a nzenach alek shway. What's because someone asked about the MTV appearance today. What will you be doing, dancing or something?
La, but it's nice to. It's nice to expand it. I like to do new shit. I like to go outside my comfort zone. Okay. For example, generally I'm an introvert. Yeah, and if you met me 3-4 years ago, usually I'd be sitting alone in a coffee shop on my iPad, not talking to anybody, nobody talking to me. If I'm at a party, I'm usually alone. I leave early, etc. So this is sort of something going outside my comfort zone. And besides, it's a way for everybody's happy. I do something new, so I'm less bored. Okay, MTV is happy, Salim Sfer is happy, Riyad Salim is happy. If they distract me with stuff like this, then I have less time to write shit about them.
Any plans to venture into mobile fees?
This is tweet. This should be a tweet.
Any plans to diversify your portfolio and create an OnlyFans account where you post nudes and stuff like that?
No, that's not likely.
Leish, طيب, leish. Let's normalize selling nudes. Normalize selling nudes. That's all right. Your favorite Twitter account? Any favorite accounts besides Mia Khalifa, of course?
I'm a big fan of Naseeb Talib. I've been known him for 20 years. I love this guy, how he thinks. You know my views on him. I think he's the greatest thinker in the last century. Now, so that I don't look like I'm kissing up to him too much. To be fair, there's not a lot of Lebanese competition. I know since we like to make money, and most of the people that have been successful, the Lebanese people, are into maximizing their net worth. He doesn't have too many competitors on the philosophical side. But that said, he's still the top guy in the last 100 years.
Interesting. I don't think he would know Gatsad, but do you know Gatsad? Have you seen do you know the account?
No, I'll look him up. No. I'll look him up. What does he do? What does he talk about?
He's a evolutionary psychologist, but he's Lebanese, Jewish Lebanese who fled during the civil war, and then he's... in Canada. He's been in Canada. Interesting stuff. I was blocked by him, just like I was blocked by many people because I just troll and trash talk on Twitter. So thank you very much for doing this, Dan. It's been, I hope, is this talk recorded? Yes, the talk is recorded and it will be posted on YouTube. I'll send you the email. I'll share it also on Twitter. So thank you guys for attending, and thanks again, Dan. This has been very interesting, like always, and I hope people found this as interesting, and see you tonight on MTV. I don't know if you want to say anything to end this.
Yep, so 8:40 on MTV. I'll be slightly above my comfort zone.
Interesting. Thanks again, and see you around.
Yalla, ciao.
Ciao. Bye-bye.